A friend of mine told me that he was looking forward to what I had to say tonight, which was encouraging. I don't think all my friends have said encouraging things. Somebody else told me that I looked like a corpse before I came into the pulpit. So I hope this friend wasn't just saying something encouraging for the sake of it, but it was reflecting what others are thinking, that this is something, a subject they're wanting to learn something about. We've taken this Christian Anne series in the hopes that these are topics which we're genuinely asking questions about. So I hope that the Christian and prosperity is something you are asking questions about. But I must admit, I had another reaction too when my friend said that he was interested to know what I had to say, because I got that slightly uncomfortable feeling, was I really going to be able to say anything positive and helpful? Because another difficulty in taking problems is that we can leave people just as muddled when we start it as when we started. I'm getting in a muddle too. I'd love to be able to give simple answers. It would be lovely to say, well, prosperity is a sign of God's blessing, and I could turn to some part of the Bible and show you that the Bible said that. And it would be nice if we could all go out of church just assuming that to be prosperous was a sign of God's blessing. Or we could turn to another part of the Bible and show Jesus teaching that we should give away everything. And it would be nice if the answer was that clear, cut and simple. At least we'd know where we stood. We would go out of church and give everything away. Or I could go back into the Old Testament and point out passages which talk about giving God a tithe, 10% of everything that we have. And that again would be a nice, clear, cut, simple answer, 90% for me and 10% for God. At least we'd know where we stood. But like many problematical topics, it's just not that simple. We can work on principles, but we've each got to work our own way towards the answers in our own lives and indeed in the world as a whole. Talking of the world as a whole, I have to admit right at the beginning that as I've looked at the vast problems facing the world when it comes to this matter of prosperity, I really have seen it best to leave those and to tackle the individual and prosperity. But of course, the two are interconnected. Lurking behind this sermon, as there has been in the prayers, is the whole thought of the third world. But I can't pretend to give answers to these economic problems. Perhaps if I tried to, I might too get a letter from Mr. Enoch Powell, as the Archbishop did when he tried to lay down some clear Christian teaching on economic problems. But it's complicated. Business ethics are complicated. The whole technological society is complicated. And yet I believe there are biblical principles which we can begin to apply to our own lives. And then as individuals in society with different responsibilities in society, do our best to apply these principles to society. And so begin to work towards God's thinking on this whole subject. Now, I've managed to find most of these principles in a couple of chapters in Luke, Luke 7 and 8. So perhaps we could turn to Luke. It's page 63 in the New Testament. And in chapter 7, if you can look along until you come to verse 31 and 32 really, Jesus is in debate with the Pharisees, as he often is, and they have been questioning some of his attitudes to life. Basically, they have been saying that Jesus enjoys life too much. And Jesus paints a picture of them as being rather like little children who are sulking. He says in verse 32, they're like children sitting in the marketplace, calling to one another, we piped to you, and you did not dance. Because he's saying that when John the Baptist came along and taught that we should be very careful in how we use worldly possessions, the Pharisees complained about him as being too extreme. But when Jesus came along and taught we should enjoy life, they complained about him. It was as though he piped a merry tune and they sat round sulking. And there is a danger that religious people can sit around sulking in the beautiful world that God has made. It's one of the dangers of religion. That's why I want to take right at the beginning this first principle that we should enjoy life. It's there right in the beginning of the Bible. God made the world and he gave it to us for our enjoyment. It's a good world given to us by a good God who longs that we should enjoy it. And Jesus demonstrated that when he came on the earth. He enjoyed eating and drinking. This is the particular argument in this passage. Jesus enjoyed so much natural human company, eating and drinking with friends. Jesus enjoyed life. He enjoyed walking. He enjoyed talking. He enjoyed music. He sang hymns with his disciples. He enjoyed poetry. He enjoyed weddings. He enjoyed supper parties. He enjoyed the beautiful world that God had made. And this is where we need to begin. We are called to enjoy God's world. Now, the problem is that the things that Jesus enjoyed were very simple things. And yet, in their own way, they were the mark and are the mark of prosperity. There are societies which have not even been able to enjoy these things. Man needs a certain freedom, a certain amount of independence financially to be able to enjoy eating and drinking and going around with friends. But Jesus set his approval very firmly on a lifestyle which had this freedom, freedom to go out and enjoy things, to enjoy God's world. So there must be resources to afford the food, to afford the drink, to afford the feasts. All these things Jesus set his approval on by joining in them quite happily. Now, we can follow Jesus in this lifestyle, but we've got certain problems because of our technological society. There are certain things available to us which were just not available in the time of Jesus. We've got a great problem as Christians working out whether these are luxuries or necessities in their own way. I think we've just got to use our imagination on this. What sort of lifestyle would Jesus have had as he came enjoying God's world in the 20th century? No doubt he would have set his approval on many of the great discoveries that man has made that have improved life and made living more comfortable and more enjoyable. But there are surely other things that he would have queried. Many of the luxuries which we perhaps take for granted, I suggest Jesus would have queried. One thing I think he would have asked us and would ask us is to what extent some of the luxuries of the 20th century life, in fact, destroy our basic enjoyment of some of the very best things in life. I think God must grieve about the direction of our industrial society sometimes. When he sees what it's doing for his world, is it really all necessary? Or is man so caught up with progress for progress's sake, progress in inverted commas, so caught up with speed, so caught up with machinery, that man is simply not stopping to enjoy the beauty, the simplicity, the wonder of nature? Jesus enjoyed these things, and I'm sure he would have very much queried some of the things that we do, the noise, the speed, the machinery, when there is such a beautiful world to enjoy without these things. Let's beware that we don't allow ourselves to get so caught up in technology, in speed, in machines, that we can't enjoy God's world. And yet, having said that, I think we must recognize from Scripture that God has given the world for us to explore. God has been with discoverers, scientific discoverers, and God approves of all that man has done to make life more enjoyable. So let's begin by praising God for life. This has been one of the themes of this service, to sit back and to give thanks. Do we recognize that we are rich? I think that's a good question to start with. Do we recognize the richness of life that God has given us? Sometimes we're so aware of what we haven't got, especially when we're looking at our friends and our neighbors, that we stop to give thanks. Fail to stop to give thanks. we fail to accept that we are rich. And this is doubly true if we are Christians, for not only do we live in a rich society with much given to us for our enjoyment, but we have spiritual blessings as well. Are our hearts full of gratitude for all that God has given us? This is where we must start, being spontaneous in our gratitude and in our enjoyment of life as God has given it to us. Now, it seems that one of the Pharisees took Jesus' words to heart, and he had Jesus back to his house for a meal, and he decided that he too would demonstrate that he enjoyed the good things that God has given. And they were eating together. This is now what carries on in the 7th chapter of Luke. And a woman came up, a woman of rather doubtful reputation, and she brought with her an alabaster flask. And in it, there was some very precious ointment, the sort of ointment that would be used for very important occasions, perhaps for burials. And it was costly. It was a luxury. It was an unnecessary thing, strictly speaking, to have. And yet, this woman had acquired some of this ointment, perhaps saved up for it over a long period. And she came, and she knelt at the feet of Jesus, and she broke it, and she anointed his feet with this oil. In a similar instance, elsewhere in the Gospels, Judas, who was standing by, questioned this very much, because he was asking about the money value of it. And the Pharisee here fails to understand why Jesus allowed this woman to do such a thing. He just saw it as a waste. He saw it as unnecessary. Generosity is, I believe, the second great principle which is going to govern our understanding of the world that God has given us. God is a generous God. He's given us a world to enjoy. And he calls us, his people, to be generous. God has demonstrated his generosity in nature. It's amazing, isn't it, how abundant nature is. It always seems to produce plenty. Now, I know again that as soon as I say that, some of us will think of that part of the world where there is not enough. But we also know, don't we, that in the world there are enough resources to feed people. It is the distribution that has broken down. God in nature demonstrates constantly his abundance. There are difficulties still, I know. But I think as we stand back and look at nature, we will recognize it is abundant. God always seems to produce plenty of everything. God enshrined his generosity in law, in the Old Testament law. He tried to show the Jewish people that he wanted them to be generous. That rather obscure passage from Leviticus showed some of these principles. There were all sorts of interesting laws. When people went out to cut the corn in the field, a lot of the ears of corn would fall on the ground. And the law said, don't go around picking up every single ear of corn. Leave it for those who have great need of it. And be generous in the amount of corn you don't bother to pick up. Strange law, but God was trying to show the people that they should be generous and leave plenty for those in need. The laws of interest. Well, the Jews weren't allowed to exact interest because God wanted to teach people to be generous in their giving and not to reduce it to economics and to business. The laws of debt were very interesting. After a certain period, people were to be released from their debts, so you didn't get a situation in which some people were becoming more and more in debt and others becoming richer and richer. And the same with land. Every 50 years, there was to be a big sort out of the land, so that people who had got into a hopeless situation about the amount of land that they had a chance to get some back, and those who'd acquired much would return it. Now, how one would apply these laws to our own complicated society, I don't pretend to know. I think we can still ask questions about whether these principles can be applied to our own society. But certainly, we can see what God is saying to his people, and we can apply these same things to ourselves. God is saying, be generous. Because I've been generous to you, let your heart constantly go out in generosity to others. And let this be practical. Let it be in the very things that cut deep, like money. Let your generosity touch your money. because how else sometimes can we demonstrate it? But already I suspect some people are a little worried about this, and you're saying, well, I'm just not rich enough to be generous. My grant's small, my parents can't afford to give me very much towards my upkeep. Or when I look round at my friends and see the way they're living, I certainly don't feel rich. I've got so far to go to catch up to their sort of standards that to think about being generous at this stage in my life is just unrealistic. What with rising prices and growing kids, who can talk about being generous in the present economic situation? Well, if that is your question, as I admit it, sometimes mine, a verse I come back to is 2 Corinthians 9:11. We won't look it up because I'm not even going to quote the RSV version. I'm going to quote the New English Bible version, which just sums up very neatly what Paul is trying to say. 2 Corinthians 9:11, you will always be rich enough to be generous. Now, I wonder whether we believe this principle is true. God is saying this here to the Corinthians. You will always be rich enough to be generous. Now, it seems the situation was that they had had great intentions of giving generously to God's work, but for one reason or another, they hadn't actually got round to it. And Paul perhaps was wondering whether they had begun to question how generous they could afford to be. And so he wrote to them this very strong spiritual and practical advice, you will always be rich enough to be generous. And to encourage them, he cited the example of poverty-stricken Christians elsewhere. And he said, look, they have given out of their extreme poverty. They're not as rich as you, and yet they have been giving generously. I think sometimes the same happens to us in the Western world today. We suddenly realize that in the third world, Christians are giving so generously that our giving is put to shame. And every now and then something touches us when we see those who've got real poverty giving generously. Just as Jesus was touched when he saw this woman giving generously to himself. There's a story told of a rather prosperous church where the offering was being taken up. And it had been for something which was certainly very important. An appeal had been made for extra money. And people were giving, but they weren't really giving generously, not to really meet the need. And as the offering plate came round, the story goes that it reached the back where there was a small girl sitting, and she was a cripple, and she hadn't much to give, but she had obviously been deeply moved by the appeal. And she simply took her crutches and she laid them on the offering plate. And at first, the fellow taking the offering was very taken aback, but he decided to accept these and to carry them out to the front to present them to God. And of course, the effect on the rest of the congregation was electric, seeing her out of her poverty giving everything, something that meant so much to her. She had understood this whole principle of generosity, overwhelming sacrificial generosity, being the only possible response to the generosity and the love of God. So there we are. We are to enjoy God's world. There is nothing wrong with enjoying all the good gifts God has given us. But this is balanced out by an overwhelming desire that others too should enjoy it. The principle of generosity. But there are a couple of other principles too. Have you ever wondered how Jesus supported himself in the 3 years that he was moving around with his disciples? There is one particular verse, and it comes up here, which gives us a clue to how he was supported. It's in Luke chapter 8 and verse 3. I doubt if you've heard of these people, Joanna and Susanna. You may have done, but they don't appear very often in Scripture. But Joanna and Susanna were typical of a group of women who moved around with Jesus sometimes and who provided for him, the end of verse 3 says, out of their means. They were obviously women who were fairly well off. We can see that one of them was quite important. Joanna was the wife of Shuza, Herod's steward. This was obviously quite a good job up at the palace, and he was a high up official at the palace and no doubt had a good income, and Joanna shared it. Now, if she had, and the other women had responded to the call of Jesus by immediately giving away everything that they had, as Jesus indeed called some people to do, they wouldn't have been able to provide constantly and steadily for Jesus as they did do over the years of his ministry. They were putting into practice a principle which Jesus himself taught, that which we sometimes call stewardship. That is, we recognize that the good gifts that God has given us, including that of money and all our other gifts and all our talents, God has given to us not to give away straight away, but to look after and to care for on his behalf and to use for his kingdom. Jesus taught this in many parables. Now, maybe Joanna saw this principle very clearly simply because her husband was who he was. She saw him handling Herod's affairs very carefully, handling perhaps his investments and his business interests. And she wanted to do the same for Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. If she had gone out and sold all her shares in Red Sea Travel or McGalilee Fisheries or whatever else she'd had, she wouldn't have been able to steward her resources carefully and provide for Jesus over these years. But she put the principle of stewardship into practice. And this is what God calls us to do as Christians. We are to be stewards of everything that he gives us, including money and possessions. They are not ours. They are given to us to enjoy. We've already established that principle. They are also given to us to give away. We've established that principle. But they are also given to us to look after carefully. There are some who have rightly been called to respond to the call of Jesus Christ by giving everything away. Some rich people have given everything away. And it may be that some are called to give up everything. Maybe true of some of us. But others, and the majority would seem, are called to steward their possessions. So when we look at our homes, our cars, our books, records, when we look at our human talents, our attitude is that these are not just mine, these are God's. True, God has given them to me to enjoy, but he's also given them to me for his kingdom, for his purposes. So my home is to be a place where God can work, where people can be welcomed, where the kingdom of God is real. So my car is to be put at the disposal of God. So everything that I have is to share with others for the kingdom. This is a very realistic principle. Sometimes, as you know, things that are totally communal are not looked after very well. I think God, understanding human nature, very wisely laid this principle down, that we are each individually responsible for certain possessions in his world. And it helps us look after them, to know that we are responsible. But we're responsible on God's behalf. There are practical problems. We've talked about the open home before. There are problems about how we use our homes for Christ. I think the phrase I used before was making them like Victoria Station, and somebody remarked afterwards that was a helpful remark, because our homes shouldn't be like that. If they're in such a mess because so many people are in and out, that's not really good stewardship. But neither is it good stewardship to keep the plastic covers on the furniture and to keep everything so spotless that we shudder if anybody comes across the front door with dirty boots or who might knock an ornament over or anything like that. That's not good stewardship. Our homes are for Christ and for his work of love. Same with our every possession. We have to work it out for ourselves. I have to work out whether it's good stewardship to lend my car to Nick Wynne-Jones. Now, his has broken down. On balance, I've decided it's just about all right. the principle of stewardship runs through the parables of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus. Look after what you've got. Look after your own gifts, your own talents. God will demand an account of what you've got. Look after your possessions. Look after everything that God entrusts to you. Value them, but use them for his service. Share them with others. And that's not an easy principle to work out in practice, but it's the principle that God gives us. And the final principle comes right on in chapter 8, because Jesus then goes on to talk about the parable of the sower, a familiar parable. And you'll remember that the third lot of seed fell among thorns, and in his interpretation in verse 14, Jesus says, this is what it means. Those that fell among thorns are those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by the cares and riches and pleasures of life, and their fruit does not mature. That is a very dramatic picture, isn't it? A young Christian, perhaps, growing up and suddenly strangled in mid-growth, or somebody becoming interested in becoming a Christian, beginning to take steps to find out about commitment to Jesus Christ, and suddenly grabbed and strangled and getting no further. That, says Jesus, is what riches can do for you. And again and again in the New Testament, he sets up a tremendous warning to us. Firstly, because riches can hold us back from ever coming to Christ in the first place. You see, riches represent and symbolize our love of personal power. I don't understand economics on a grand scale, but I do understand it when I play a game like Monopoly. And when I play Monopoly, I notice that I become incredibly benevolent when I'm winning, and that I love not to put my partners out of the game, but to give great sums of money to them to keep them in the game, because I know I'm right on top. You see, money represents power, and it's power in the end that I'm more interested in than having lots of money. If everybody else is out of the game, that's miserable. But if I've got power over everybody else, and they're still just about tottering around, and if they land on Mayfair, you know, I can benevolently say, well, I'll let you off this time. That's great. Money is power, and it's power, the love of personal power, which stops us from coming to Christ, stops us making that surrender to the living God. And many people balk on that issue as to whether they will surrender their will and their love of power to Jesus Christ. That is why you remember the rich young ruler came to Jesus, and Jesus questioned him about his moral standards and eventually pinned him down on the issue of money. And he said, give away everything that you've got. Because he realized that until that man was utterly broken on that point, he would not have surrendered his will to God. And it may well be that for somebody to come to Christ today, money is a crucial issue, and the willingness to renounce acquiring a fortune, or to renounce a particular job which builds up money by somewhat dubious means, that may be part and parcel of somebody's surrender to Jesus Christ in the first place. But secondly, money is a danger because it can stifle the growth of a Christian. Now, we've all got this problem up to a point that we are secure enough, every one of us, I suspect, in this church, not to have often had to pray, give us this day our daily bread, desperately meaning it. Maybe we have had the experience, and if you have, you will know what a tremendous experience it is to pray, not knowing where today's food is going to come from, and seeing God provide it. But most of us are cushioned from a lot of the insecurity which life can give, and yet which drives us to seek God. That's why Jesus said, blessed are the poor. Not because Jesus gloried in poverty for its own sake. Jesus didn't think that everybody should be desperately poor. We've already seen that. He enjoyed a reasonable standard of living. But Jesus saw that the poor were in a position to come to God for their riches, materially and spiritually. And therefore he said, blessed are the poor, because that is a tremendous thing. To see a man who is poverty-stricken in himself spiritually, because he has material security is tragic. And of course, it is the tragedy of our own society and the tragedy we see all around us. People who are poverty-stricken spiritually and mentally and emotionally, and yet they've always got enough money to buy another bag of fish and chips or to buy a colour telly. And it's a tragedy. And Jesus said, blessed are the poor. They've not got that problem. Let's pray that we don't get in a position where our riches, our prosperity, cloud our dependence on God. And then, of course, like anybody else in the world, the love of money, the root of all evil, can creep into our hearts constantly as a Christian. And I've no doubt it does yours as it does mine. We love money. We love the power that it gives us, the freedom that it gives us, and the independence that it gives us to do just what we want when we want. Covetousness and greed are idolatry, the Bible tells us. The worshipping of money and of material possessions is an alternative to the worshipping of the living God. You cannot serve God and money. The Christian is again and again being called to make that decision for one or the other. Is it to be God or is it to be money? You cannot serve them both. Either we master money or money masters us and becomes a rival God in our hearts. Of course, poverty produces its temptations as well. The person who lives in poverty can be greedy and can be covetousness. Perhaps we can understand why. And yet, sadly, riches don't satisfy the human heart. They make it more covetous and more grasping and more scheming than it ever was before. Is that not true? No wonder Jesus said, beware of money. Beware of the thorns that choke. Beware what they do for your spiritual life and your whole personhood, for they can destroy. So, therefore, let us enjoy money, not for its own sake, but for the things that it can buy us, which God means us to enjoy. But let us watch our lifestyle carefully, that it doesn't in fact destroy our basic enjoyment of life, having so much. And let's be generous in the society around us and to the world as a whole. Let's pour out our gifts and our money as God has poured out everything to us. Let's be wise in the way we look after our affairs, our money, and our possessions. And let's be constantly on the watch that the devil doesn't get in the back door and start choking up our hearts again through the love of money and material things. Paul said in Philippians, I've learned the secret of facing hunger and plenty, abundance and want. For I have learned in whatsoever state I am to be content. Paul's security was centered on God. And therefore, when he went through times of poverty, it was no problem. When he went through times when money was coming in, he knew how to handle it because he had got his sight straight. Christ was the center of everything. And beside that, money and possessions fell happily into perspective. Let's pray this can be our aim as well.